Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And as we kind of just talked yesterday, because it kind of came out from the Treasury, that the federal government's insolvent, that they are having problems paying their bills, and that what are they going to do? Well, we basically have to take all our power back and get them out of doing things they have no authority to do, that's not left to them to do anything they want. One of the things that you should have garnered right now, or over the past few weeks, or almost 2 months now since we've been doing the Constitutional Convention with James Madison's notes, is the concept of the assuming of debt. They actually threw it out there that the federal government would be able to assume the state's debts as long as it had something to do with the war of the general defense and common welfare of the Union. They would do that only for the prior. But moving forward, they wouldn't do that. But when the Constitution was finally written, they decided not to do that, that the federal government couldn't do those things. They can't bail out states. In other words, folks, they deliberately decided that the federal government was not going to tax the Union to provide welfare to the states for their debt, or corporations for that matter. There was no handing of money for the purposes and intent of welfare. As we kind of look and going through this, and we look at our financial woes, and I've been telling you that the catalyst, I may be completely wrong here, and that's okay. And I'm not claiming to be a clairvoyant. But the catalyst that will force America to go into the arms of the global governance and put aside the Constitution for once and for all will be a financial meltdown. And it's either we do this willingly or we lose everything, because they're convincing you that everything is lost, that this debt is legitimate. But folks, I don't know how long you've been listening, but if you've noticed, every show starts off with that debt is fraud. And I've been saying it for years and years and years to ad nauseum. And it's just like, there's not enough people getting it. Prove me wrong. Prove me wrong this day that I am absolutely wrong, that they have the authority to spend the money on anything and everything they want. And I know you can't do that, and you know you can't do that. So the question is, why is it that most people don't understand this? Why is it that, and I'll take a leap here, because I want you to understand the whole point of what I'm trying to say. This is a really bad job in marketing. Because I'm right, because nobody can refute what I'm saying, the judges can't, the judges won't like it, but they can't refute it, and they'll make a decision against it. It's the same thing with the academics. They'll make decisions against it because they don't like it. Why would the academics not like the fact that, you know, all of this debt is fraud? Because we don't have the authority to give the academics money, and that's where they get their funding from. Yeah, you see, this is why conservative entertainers are making millions of dollars talking about the problem but never solving the problem, because the problem is getting everybody rich. You solve this problem and there's no more pouring out of money, your money, paying for it. This is why I was talking yesterday about the economics of this. It literally capitulates this outward flow of opulence to whom, you know, these loyalists and everything else get selected and picked and become in people. They're the in crowd. They're the blessed ones. That goes away. Everybody is thrown back onto this field of an even playing field, and the amount of money in circulation will go down dramatically, which means that the value of the dollar would go up significantly. to where maybe a dollar would be worth a silver dollar again. And a $20 bill would be worth $20 again. As we go through this, I didn't get a chance to really poke the eye here because this is my bad marketing. The only reason that no people are talking about this, the only reason Carl Tucker will make a conscious decision not to talk to G.R. Mobley or any of these people that go, wow, this is really fascinating, you're making some real outlandish claims, because they don't want it to hit the press. They don't want the mainstream to get this. Why? Because they're making money. But the real point is that until you demand and until you start poking people in the eye, because you hear me poke people in the eye all the time. I poke organizations that claim to be constitutional. I call them out. You're not constitutional. You're self-serving. You're controlled opposition. And you know those organizations and who they are. Three letters or whatever. You know who they are. Because for years I've been telling you that they have no vested interest in solving the problem. They are only seeking, as a matter of fact, one of the things I learned about the three-letter organization is they have retirement liabilities that they can't, they're having a hard time keeping up with. Because they've had these employees who have retired, and their retirement's pretty nice, and that's why their cost of becoming membership has gone up from 50 to 100, I guess, now. But nevertheless, the point is that everything that they're doing is for self-serving purposes. It's not really to solve the problem and say, hey, everybody that, you know, we owe you a retirement, we can't do it anymore, we're going bottoms up or whatever you want to call it, bankruptcy, we're out, we're done. Because that would be a good thing. Welcome back, Sean and Tammy. Would it not be a good thing to say we're better off not being able to pay these people the retirement and actually solve the problem and get rid of all of these problems than it would be to just say, hey, you know, our loyalty isn't towards the Constitution, the rule of law. Our loyalty is to our retirees and those who, you know, we've created these trusts with. What do you think?
My grandpa said the first rule to getting out of a hole is to stop digging.
There you go. And Tammy, what do you think?
I think we just need to not pay it anymore.
Right, but so, you know, if you actually start looking at some of these long-term heritage, that's not the three-digit, three-letter, you know, organization. I'm being nice today. But I just called out the heritage. But, I mean, if you go through any of these organizations that have any kind of structure where there's money pumping through these things, where the CEO is making some good bank, you know, hey, that retirement package and everything else, as you've been doing it for years and years and years, all of a sudden you have a huge liability. And now all of a sudden you have a problem. You got in the game to say, we're going to solve the problem. And now you've been shackled to the idea that your problem is funding the monster you created. Back to the whole point of this bad marketing scheme. You need to be the ones poking your friends and everybody in the eye. And I know if you listen to, you know, all of these other different conservative entertainers, you need to say you're completely wrong on this. There's a hardcore solution. It's called full compliance with the Constitution. It's got to start in the counties. We've got to start forcing constitutional compliance throughout the states and get the states to demand full compliance out of the federal government. It can happen quickly. But it only happens when you start flapping your gums. It only happens by word of mouth. And any, you know, sales, if you talk to anybody that's involved in sales, the best advertisement is direct word of mouth, because when you're talking to people, you know they know you. And if you have any credibility, any credentials with them, what you say means a lot more than that paid advertisement to say, I am paid to say these, you know, to endorse this product. You know, obviously that's what these people are, but they're now forced to say that. But my point is that you need to start getting people to start slamming this radio show, the podcast, and everything else by listening to it. by asking questions if you're not learning anything. I've availed myself. I've offered, if you've got a movement going on and you've got you want to get things kicked off or started, call. I will help. I'm helping all sorts of people, and the problem is that, and this becomes this is not a unique problem. When people come along and they say, I want to help, I want to get involved, but they want to be they want to be in the executive board. They don't want to actually do the work that needs to be done right now at the county level, getting the county work and those types of the tactical things. Oh no, I'm really smart with strategic stuff. Well, everybody probably is, I guess. Nobody wants to roll up their sleeves and do the job and do the work. Now, I've been writing petitions, so I need help with petitions. Well, I don't want to do that. See, my point is that if you come and you say, I want to help, then don't come and say, I want to help do this one thing. Because 9 times out of 10, it's either not that important or I'm doing it. So we have to actually start sucking it up. We actually have to start doing the dishes, doing the windows, the vacuuming. We're going to have to press our clothes. Well, we're going to have to launder them first. I know some guys would just start putting the iron on the dirty pants and clothing. Because, guys do that. They don't want to go through the full cycle of washing and drying. It's all about looks, right? Yeah, so that mustard stain may be a little problem. But nevertheless, the point is that we've got to get the work done. This work does not get itself done. How many times have you heard somebody say, hey, that hot fudge sundae is not going to eat itself? The consumption of that hot fudge sundae is work. It's effort. Just like vacuuming the floor. Now, there may be a huge difference in eating a hot fudge sundae and vacuuming the floor, but either way, it requires work to get it done. So as far as I'm concerned, everything requires effort. So I just qualify everything to effort. And we need a lot of effort because the time is clicking and it's clicking fast. If you don't feel any urgency, then I felt the urgency years ago, and I stopped watching TV. And I can tell you that there's so much disinformation on television. Stop watching TV and start learning this stuff. Once you start learning the Constitution, everything starts screaming at you. Every time you hear something like, well, that's not constitutional. They don't have the authority to do that. That's how bad it is. So anyway, let's get into the constitutional notes, Madison's notes. We kind of wrapped up on sumptuary taxes and our sumptuary laws. And so now we want to get back to the militia. So here we are on, let me see here. This is Tuesday, August 21st, and this is on page 337. At least it is on mine, and when I get this to you, it'll be right there or really close. You'll be within the top or bottom of the page. Anywho, we're again talking about the militia and debt and going through this. So, and actually, they're still talking about assuming state debt. Okay? And so, Tammy, why don't you go through Governor Livingston's comments and his suggestions to language to go into the Constitution?
Okay. Governor Livingston, from the Committee of 11, to whom was referred the propositions respecting the debts of the several states and also the militia entered on the 18th, delivered to the following report. Mm-hmm. The legislature of the U.S. shall have power to fulfill the engagements which have been entered into by Congress and to discharge as well the debts of the U.S. as the debts incurred by the several states during the late war for the common defense and general welfare. To make laws for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the U.S., reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by the United States.
Okay, so that last part regarding the militia is pretty close to the language that actually goes into the Constitution now. So they've been kind of cleaning up the militia pretty easily. But let's look at the assumption of debt just above that. The legislature of the United States Congress shall have the power to fulfill engagements which shall have been entered into by Congress and to discharge as well the debts of the United States and the debts incurred by the several states during the late war for the common defense and general welfare. They're looking to put that into the Constitution. So in other words, this idea of assuming debt finally grew legs to this language in the Constitution. Now, one of the things that Madison's note covers and doesn't, or I should say, one of the things his notes don't cover is all of the debates when things got weeded out. So what we can see is this is happening. This idea has, a bad idea has grown legs. And those legs have actually worked its way into the language like the admission of states. We saw the language on admission of states that the Congress shall have the power to regulate the apportionment and representation of these new states being admitted. And these other powers that they could actually reduce their sovereignty. That language, as we've been seeing, has kind of been whittled down a little bit. But ultimately, as we see some of these things happening and the language has changed or completely dropped certain points, now we know that somewhere it happened. In some committee, the committee basically said, we got to get rid of that. That just doesn't fly. And so what they do is they change this, or they change this language. And this committee of 11, apparently, was a very powerful committee because it was one person, one of the key people from each of the states, probably. And they went in and they kind of came up with what the language that they felt would was appropriate and or whether it was appropriate to be in the Constitution. Therefore, we won't find why some of these things fell out. What matters is that it fell out. It was not included. Yeah, it had this life. You know, it's kind of like an atomic bomb and the half-life of the radiation and all those things that over, you know, years it dissipates. Well, through the convention, these bad bombs that were thrown out there had these half-lives and maybe, you know, one bomb lasted a week and some of them went months. But ultimately, they lost interest, they died, and they were no longer relevant when it came to the language of the Constitution. If you look for the words incurred in the federal Constitution, i.e. regarding the debts, as the debts incurred, you'll find that that language doesn't exist. Or by the several states during the late war for the common defense, that language doesn't exist in the Constitution. But this is the 11, actually, the Committee of 11 actually putting it in. So they're still chewing on this because something happens. We know something happens because that doesn't show up. But the language below that, that's pretty close more to what is what you'd find in Article 1, Section 8, subsection, I think, 15. Anyway, Mr. Gary then says this. Go ahead, Sean.
Mr. Gary considered giving the power only without adopting the obligation as destroying the security now enjoyed by the public creditors of the United States. He enlarged on the merit of this class of citizens and the solemn faith with which had been pledged under existing confederation. If their situation should be changed as here proposed, great opposition would be excited against the plan. He urged also that as the states had made different degrees of exertion to sink their respective debts, those who had done most would be alarmed. If they were now to be saddled with a share of the debts of states which had done least.
Interesting. Now, see, he's pointing out this obvious, that those of us who actually had behaved, or those states that behaved badly, would actually be punishing the states that behaved well. This is why Hamilton had to concoct an idea, this concoction that he created a benefit to the states that paid into it, as well as created a benefit for the states that they're assuming the debt for. So in other words, it's almost like they're saying, okay, we're going to assume debt for everybody, and but we're going to give you these stocks, these bonds, what have you, and you're going to make money off of that to basically pay off debt you've already paid off. So you're really not paying off anything. And but the states that, and you need to sell off this many bonds. In other words, as a state, you need to take this and sell these off and so forth. You got to remember that this whole plan that Hamilton concocted, it failed. The bank went belly up. That's a better expression. So as the bank went belly up, a lot of people got hurt, because many people that were close in government and close in banking and so forth were heavily vested, like John Adams. John Adams, when the bank, when he lost everything, and I say everything, then he had to move in and live with his son John Quincy Adams, him and Abigail. By that point in time, all their kids were grown up, so it was just, you know, kind of going into, what do they call that? A casita? In the Southwest, they have like a mother-in-law home, a casita. Anyway, and I may have that completely wrong because I'm bad with names, but that's okay. I don't mean to offend anybody, and I hope that nobody feels offended. I don't. Anyway. See, my wife tells me that I do believe I'm funny, but most people don't think I'm funny. All right, so the next thing we go to is Wednesday the 22nd, 1787, and we're talking about property and slavery, and this is where Tammy, go ahead and pick this up. Article 4, Section 4, or 7, Section 4.
Wait, what page are we on?
Oh, I'm sorry, we're down on...
Okay, got it, never mind.
Okay, hold on. Let me do the preface here. This is the day of the compromise. This is the day when the decision is done, and Mason has a meltdown. And we're going to read Mason's meltdown. Actually, Sean will, because it's the next paragraph. So I just wanted to prepare everybody. This is the big day. Go ahead.
Okay, resumed. Mr. Sherman was leaving the clause as it stands. He disapproved of the slave trade, yet as the states were now possessed of the right to import slaves, as the public good did not require it to be taken from them, and as it was expedient to have as few objections as possible to the proposed scheme of government, he thought it best to leave the matter as we find it. He observed that the abolition of slavery seemed to be going on in the U.S., and that the good sense of the several states would probably by degrees complete it. He urged on the convention the necessity of dispatching its business.
Okay, so in other words, what Sherman just said was, let's not even make slavery an issue with the Constitution. It is strictly a state issue. States' rights, state power, let's not be involved. The South was insisting that it be a part of the Constitution because they wanted apportionment for their slaves. And so, you know, what Sherman was saying was, to me, I think, a complete disconnect from the reality of the real heart of the problem. Now, I could tell Sean to go ahead and let's jump into this, but as I look, we've got barely a minute. So, but we've covered a lot of ground on slavery already, right, Sean?
Yes, sir.
And so this is the day of this particular compromise. And as a matter of fact, I don't think Madison does himself any justice here, because if I go through this, I look and I do not see Madison's meltdown at all on this day. He makes one comment at the very end of the day, and because it came from another source, I think it was Mason himself that basically pointed out to everybody that Madison, when this deal was made, when Mason had his meltdown, Madison, because maybe it's the language of 1808, when that year was actually galvanized in the Constitution, which may have been a different day. But Madison had his own little meltdown because Madison basically stated, and this was documented in other people's notes, how Madison basically said, who's going to remember in 20 years from now, if this Constitution is ratified, who's going to remember that that little clause and what that means? Nobody's going to know. Anyway, we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so in all fairness, when we look at that 1808 clause, again, I'm not sure if that was already done, but I know Madison had a problem with it. He wanted it to, the language to either be very clear, because this is when the federal government would basically use regulations to end the slave trade. That language in Article 1, Section 9, which are restrictions placed upon the federal government. In subsection 1 of Section 9, that is exactly what that whole subsection is about, that the federal government shall not be able to regulate or get involved in the immigration or importation of persons until the year of 18,008. And that as such, they will then be able to regulate the importation of persons, regulate them. In other words, be able to put negatives on them, but doesn't say specifically what those negatives would be, which is why the divine hand of providence basically answered Madison's question. Because Madison's question was, who's going to be around to remember that that line even exists in the Constitution? And who became president in 1808? James Madison. I'll bet you he remembered. And I'll bet you there was no hesitation on that man's part to make sure that the slave regulations were literally imposed by Congress, and that he started using the Navy and all resources he could to ensure that they were blocking all of the slaves that they were trying to import into these southern states. It got underhanded to a point where you kind of create an embargo or a stop on the trade of something coming in, like, you know, let's say Cuban cigars. I don't know if you're a cigar smoker. It says, Tammy, you're probably, out of the three of us, probably the most likely to be a cigar smoker. How easy is it, do you think, to get, because there's a blockade, you know, it's a ban, you can't buy Cuban cigars in America. How hard is it for you to get Cuban cigars?
I have no idea.
Okay, so
I've never tried.
Yeah, okay. But do you think there's a black market for it?
Oh, for sure.
For sure. Because the Cuban cigars are a highly desirable item because they made it illegal. Right? So whenever something becomes illegal, then all of a sudden the value of it goes up. Because the cost of you getting it and all that stuff has to be mitigated, and it goes up exponentially by the desirability. That's why people pay big-time dollars for Cuban cigars. So my point is that when they created this blockade, well, the Southerners, they said, okay, well, we'll work around this. Instead of ships coming in from Africa, they'll be none the wiser if the ships are coming in with slaves from South America or what have you if they're carrying a different flag. So they started, you know, carrying different flags and bringing, you know, small amounts of slaves with other cargo to mask them and so forth. So they tried to work around it in any and every way possible. And the reason that it got to a point, because if in 1822, Monroe announces his Monroe Doctrine, I think it was 1822, 1823, 24, somewhere in there, the Monroe Doctrine is established. A part of that was the fact that some nations, some European nations, Britain and others that wanted to bring contraband and do other things, they started operating out of Central America and Latin America and bringing the things that we wouldn't allow or we didn't want coming in to go there and then come in, because we were very good at stopping it coming from Britain or whatever the country was, but bringing it in a secondary carrier made it a little easier. So the idea of getting around those types of trade stoppages or regulations and so forth have been around for centuries. And when the desire is there to maintain something, to have something, that means that they're willing to pay more for it. But anyway, let me let you, Sean, now get into what Mason basically said when they galvanized this deal. Go ahead.
Colonel Mason of Virginia, this infernal traffic originated in the avarice of British merchants. The British government constantly checked the attempts of Virginia to put a stop to it. The present question concerns not the importing states alone, but the whole Union. The evil of having slaves was experienced during the late war. Had slaves been treated as they might have been by the enemy, they would have proved dangerous instruments in their hands. But their folly dealt by the slaves as it did by the Tories. He mentioned the dangerous insurrections of the slaves in Greece and Sicily, and the instructions given by Cromwell to the commissioners sent to Virginia to arm the servants and slaves in case other means of obtaining its submission should fail. Maryland and Virginia, he said, had already prohibited the importation of slaves expressly. North Carolina had done the same in substance. All this would be in vain if South Carolina and Georgia be at liberty to import. The Western people are already calling out for slaves for their new lands and will fill that country with slaves if they can be got through South Carolina and Georgia. Slavery discourages arts and manufactures. The poor despise labor when performed by slaves. They prevent the immigration of whites who really enrich and strengthen a country. They produce the most pernicious effect on manners. Every master of slaves is born a petty tyrant. They bring the judgment of heaven on a country. As nations cannot be rewarded or punished in the next world, they must be in this. By an inevitable chain of causes and effects, Providence punishes national sins by national calamities. He lamented that some of our Eastern brethren had from a lust of gain embarked in this nefarious traffic. As to the states being in possession of the right to import, this was the case with many other rights now to be properly given up. He held it essential in every point of view that the general government should have power to prevent the increase of slavery.
You know, in this one little paragraph, we get a really good fidelity to the nation at the time. Because one of the things that, you know, most people don't know is the northeastern states, as much as they abhorred and they looked down upon the heathens that were using slavery, they got into the carrying of slaves for their consumption. You see that? These were hypocrites up there.
And, absolutely.
And so, in other words, it was really showing how, you know, anybody would do anything for the dollar and this lust of, you know, being for the profits. Because the lust of profits for the plantation owners, that's what drove them to be able to maintain slavery instead of actually employing people. And as a matter of fact, if you read Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith goes down the whole point that it is far more efficient and it is far better to have employees doing work for you and taking care of them, you know, letting them live on your, you know, plantation, what have you, but let them be employed and give them their freedom, you know, and punish them with, you know, the deductions of pay or what have you for damages done or whatever. But bottom line, it is far better to have an employee than it is a slave, because a slave will cost you more money. And the Southerners, they wouldn't have it. The Southern states, they just wouldn't have it. I mean, they could have been bringing black immigrants into America easily and giving them jobs, because they weren't willing to do it. And so it wouldn't take long for the entrepreneurial, you know, of anybody. It doesn't matter race or gender or anything, sex or anything else. What really matters is, hey, you really want this done. You can't get anybody else to do it, and I'm willing to do it, and you're paying me this, so I bet you'd pay me this much for it. And if you've ever watched Plane, Trains, and Automobiles, there was this point where Steve Martin ran down this cab, and a lawyer kind of took claim of the cab, or this businessman, supposedly. I think he was a lawyer, but Steve Martin said, hey, you know, you look like a reasonable guy. I'll give you $100 if you just let me have the cab. And he goes, you know what? I'll let you have the cab, but if you're willing to pay me $100, then clearly you'd be willing to pay me. And he goes much higher than that, $300, whatever. And he goes, you know, he says something, you know, very derogatory about, you know, his business tact or what have you. And I think this is when he fesses up, yeah, I'm a lawyer. The point is, though, that type of spirit exists. You know, the only reason why certain jobs that do not require a lot of skill but still pay really well is due to probably the dangers involved. You know, like, I remember they were paying people, I mean, we even talked about this, how much they pay people to go weld. I mean, we're talking about welding at the bottom of the ocean. It takes a while to get down there, and it takes a long time to come back up, for the compression or the decompression, all that, to come back up. And there's, you know, a good risk of death. You're down there all by yourself, or, you know, very limited support at all. So what do you do? Well, okay, so at that point, you know, you're trying to get that stuff done. You got to get that welding done. So how much do they end up paying? And Sean, you should probably know, what is the average pay for one of these oil line welders at the bottom of the Gulf? The Gulf of Mexico.
I'm not sure, but wouldn't take me but a minute.
Yeah, so as I understood it, these guys only work like 4 months out of the year, and they make $500,000?
Yeah, they're doing really well. I know that.
Yeah, okay. So my point is that, you know, Mason really laid it out there. And he gave us a really good shot of, I'll call it, the hypocrisy, everything that was going on regarding slavery, you know, and what he foresaw. He foresaw the national calamities are going to come because we're maintaining this, because we've got that blood on our hands because of this. And so Mr. Ellsworth then pipes in. He says, go ahead, Tammy.
Mr. Ellsworth, as he had never owned a slave, could not judge the effects of slavery on character. He said, however, that if it was to be considered in a moral light, we ought to go farther and free those already in the country. As slaves also multiply so fast in Virginia and Maryland that it is cheaper to raise than import them, whilst the sickly rice swamps, foreign supplies, are necessary. If we go no farther than is urged, we shall be unjust toward South Carolina and Georgia. Let us not intermeddle. As population increases, poor laborers will be so plenty as to render slaves useless. Slavery in time will not be a speck in our country. Provision is already made in Connecticut for abolishing it, and the abolition has already taken place in Massachusetts. As to the danger of insurrections from foreign influence, that will become a motive to kind treatment of the slaves.
Okay, thank you. So one of the things that kind of comes up, do either of you remember history that you were taught? Okay, so let me get into the specifics. Let me get into the specifics, because that's a dumb question. Yeah, I kind of remember, but that's a huge setup, because, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that was taught and wasn't taught. Okay, so there was a contraption, the development and the invention of a contraption in the 1790s, they say, galvanized the need for slavery. The cotton gin. How was that? How did that invention maintain the demand that slave labor, not employed labor, exist? Do you understand how that worked? Because I'd like to know, because I've heard historians say that. But I believe that the historians were paid by the pens of the slave owners to basically say that, to help justify this insidious business, this insidious institution. Because how is it that basic labor, unskilled labor, required slavery instead of just paying somebody a minimum wage or whatever? You got labor, there's people out there that are willing to work. It may save you money a little bit, but bottom line, again, you don't have the liability. Okay, so Mr. Pickney, go ahead, Sean.
I can comment on that.
Go ahead.
One of the reasons is because it made it so efficient that it became highly profitable. It cut the overhead because the slaves were only required to plant and harvest the cotton, not process it. They could process the cotton much more efficiently with the machinery than they could with the slaves. So that cut a lot of their overhead. They could use those slaves for planting and harvesting instead of processing.
But my point is that let's look at the... So there's a cost to having slaves by having the security of having slaves. You got to have armed guards and so forth to contain your slaves. You have to have, you know, all of this security.
You have to feed them. You have to
right.
Have a place for and you to stay.
What was that, Tammy? Go ahead.
I mean, you'd have to feed them, have a place for them to stay. You have to provide some type of health care.
Right.
Something.
Food, subsistence, you know, a place to stay. In other words, you're housing these people. Wouldn't it be cheaper not to hire these hired hand guns and the handlers and everything else and actually be dealing with people that speak English instead of all of those cumbersomes of, you know, the language barriers and everything else? And, you know, oh, well, you know, see, there was both a moral issue to this, because many of the slave owners, they didn't care. They wouldn't spare, you know, the whip or anything to punish. They treated these people like animals. And
I think it's the bondage issue is more. I'm not trying to contradict you, but I don't think the math is working out right, that it was just the same amount of money, the same profit for hired labor as it would be for slave labor. Because you say, oh, well, they had to feed them and they have to house them. Yeah, but they could house them in a dirt floor shack with 10 people in it, and they could feed them just enough to where they could subside enough to work. And a hired laborer is not going to live like that. So, I mean... Like I said, I'm not trying to contradict you, but I think there's a very big difference in the profit margins between absolutely free labor. Yeah, you have to maintain it like a tractor or something.
Yeah.
But hired labor is going to be a whole different scenario
than
free labor that is in bondage by force.
So Adam Smith...
If you don't treat the hired people right, they'd walk off.
So Adam Smith makes...
The slave can't walk off.
Okay, so Adam Smith makes these arguments because the attitude as well as the motivation of somebody being paid by the amount of work they do instead of being forced to do work. Because, you know, they may have to beat their backs more. The more you beat their backs, the less they're able to work, or you create these problems. So if you're not doing things in the best ways, the most efficient ways possible, then you're making bad business decisions. And Adam Smith argued the case that the need of slavery, you know, could easily be replaced by better labor and more efficient labor, because now you've incentivized people to work. You've incentivized them to work more because you pay them more. And it may seem like you're dipping into your profits, but you're really not dipping into your profits if you're saving money by not having these other overhead costs. Now I don't have to employ people. Now I don't have to have, you know, if we go to war, I have to have extra security. Instead, okay, I may lose employers. These guys were self-serving. But my point is that when you really start looking at the carrot and the stick in motivating labor, the productivity goes up more when you use the carrot than you use the stick.
Yeah.
And so you may have those outliers, because there's going to be that guy that, you know, doesn't even want to have a job. They just have a job because they need a job. And they just, because I've had those employees. And I think that we are seeing some of this because our society has created entitlement. Back in those days, they didn't have an entitlement problem. They had a survival problem, because there were plenty of times when they were starving and in bad need of subsistence and everything else through the long winters, because they had too many, like the earlier show, they had too many grasshoppers and not enough ants. But bottom line is that I'd like to see somebody actually prove the model of how the cotton gin, I understand that it made part of that process so that it freed up labor to do other things. Okay, well, good. But why did that labor have to be slave labor and not incentivized? You could even reduce your labor when you incentivize it more, right? When you have the union, when the union comes in, you've lost all incentive, because everybody gets paid equal. You're no longer paid by merit. You're paid because everybody gets the same pay, and the new guy that comes in that tries to show off, he quickly gets shut down by everybody on that line to say, look, you're going to produce 5 of those just like the rest of us. You produce 20, and you're going to have problems. And the day the guy comes in and makes 20, and all of a sudden he can't walk because something happened to his knees. That's what the union does, is they constrict your productivity. Having a merit system, and what we call capitalism, is a far better economic system in employment, productivity, and so forth. I mean, look at how so many different corporations have incentivized. Have you ever heard of SAS? There's a really, I'll look this up, because I used to use this in helping people understand, because it was part of business courses as well. There was this software company called SAS, and it was not a publicly traded company, but it was the most desirable. They turned down the best and the brightest engineers in the world because they were taking the cream of the crop of the best, because they had no problem having people come work for them. And when the people work for them, they're still working for them to this day. At least, I don't know if they ever went public, but they said the day they go public is the day everything that they've done will be lost. Because when they go public, they have to basically start serving the investors instead of, you know, serving the machine of the system itself, the employees, the company, and everything else. And the owner was very clear. He said, I'm making more than enough profits that I don't care. And I have employees that will die with me. He actually had, if you look at the SAS Corporation in this video, 60 Minutes did this exposure. He gave them their homes. I mean, they had to pay for, I think, whatever the costs were and all of that. But he gave up property right there. He had this huge, I think this is in the Carolinas, and he had this huge property. He had golf courses and so forth. It was a dream job. And it was a dream job because it was privately maintained, not publicly maintained. So this kind of even shows you the difference between a public corporation versus a private corporation. And so anyway, for what it's worth, I don't see the empirical data that really supports slave labor ever. It was the easy thing to do by using the gun, and it was the biggest sin man could do, because it got us to get other people to subsist to provide a subsistence by the sweat of their brow instead of by the sweat of our own brow. And I will also say this as my closing point, and whatever you want to say as a final comment, that's fine. But my closing point is this, that I believe that when you treat people righteously, like if you invoked the Jubilee and the order of God of slavery and so forth of the Old Testament, then I believe that you could have slavery that would, you know, be copacetic with those people, that, you know, they would either want to be treated, they like, I want to work here again. If you let them free after 6 years, on the seventh year, they go free. And if they want to stay, then they stay. It's up to them. Some things like that, but there's no doubt in my mind, when you do right by people and you are doing righteous things, God blesses you. And I believe that these corporations are the people who would have broken ranks. And I truly believe that when we really look at the South, the North couldn't win. In the Civil War, there was 2 years of defeat. Because Lincoln was trying to use the might and the power of unconstitutional authority. When he finally made it about a righteous issue over slavery instead of you can't leave the Union, then it became a righteous issue. And then next thing you know, the North couldn't lose. The South kept on losing, and the war turned just that fast. So his hand is in all things, and I truly believe that these states could have actually transitioned if they would have done the righteous things and tried to seek, you know, his involvement in how to successfully move forward, even with the advent of the cotton gin. That's just, I just look at it that way. They would have been blessed had they done that. But instead, they became a scourge, and like Mason said, like you read, that God will punish these national sins with calamities, and that Civil War was that calamity.
We're still dealing with that judgment today.
Yes,
with the racial issues in the country.
Correct.
So if you read Jeremiah 34, you'll see where the Lord punished Israel for not freeing their slaves. The same kind of thing, and I'm not like directly connecting one to the other. Also, a little trivia. Do you know where the idea for the cotton gin actually came from?
No, I don't.
They observed slaves when they were working, trying to process the cotton. They were in these rooms that had wooden floors, and the floors were old, and they had cracks between them. And the slaves figured out that if they pushed the cotton into the cracks, they could pop the seeds out much easier than doing it simply by hand. And that's where the actual ideas for the cotton gin came about.
Oh, okay. So the innovation was actually done because people were trying to work smarter, not harder.
Right. Exactly.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And so I don't think, so we're basically out of time. I appreciate the points of view. And Tammy, you know, I know you're just not waiting to go get a cigar because I know you don't smoke cigars, but I hope you did take. I hope you didn't take offense to that. For what it's worth,
no, I did not.
Right. For what it's worth, you know, women are not the sex of toting a big stogie and, you know, puffing those big smoke circles and so forth. So anyway, I thought I'd have a little laugh at my expense and everybody else's, I guess. But anyway, thank you both. Thank you both for your participation today. And we will be back tomorrow covering more of Madison's Notes on the 22nd of August. We're wrapping it down, though, folks. We're getting pretty close to moving into the ratification debate. So it's going to get hot real fast. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.